Welcome to Island Idols.
I'm Barry Menikoff calling in from Honolulu, and you are...
Aaron Menikoff calling in from Atlanta, and this is a podcast about books and life. Welcome back to Island Idols. Here we are for episode 21. Episode 21 on the topic of Edith Wharton, and especially her very small book, Ethan Frome. Dad, do you call this book a novella or just a short story or a long story?
Well, you know, there's a whole controversy as to what makes a short story short and when does a short story become too long to be a short story. And we don't have to get into it, but it qualifies as a long story or a novella.
A novella. I like that word novella. I don't think anyone really uses that word.
They try to sometimes use the word, the French word is sometimes used, nouvelle.
Oh.
Henry James used that word, the nouvelle, which should be the equivalent of the novella. And then sometimes the Americans tried to come up with their own version, calling it a novelette, but I don't think that ever passed.
A novelette. Well, I just feel smarter saying novella.
But you are.
And actually, I read that when this book came out, Americans weren't reading a lot of novels.
Really?
So this book came out in 1911. And
I never heard that.
You've never heard that before? Well, let's just dig right into it. There's no need to talk about COVID-19.
No.
There's no need to get into that.
It's been with us for a long time, so we may as well just accept
it. Let's move on. And I can't get you sick right now because you're basically just a two-dimensional figure on a computer screen.
Well, thank you very much for that. I actually have a third dimension, but we'll let that go for now.
Okay, but you know, I
want to say one thing about Edith Wharton. Edith Wharton.
I hope you say more than that because this whole episode is devoted to her.
Edith Wharton is the first great female American writer. Now, that would probably be a line by itself that's going to get a lot of controversy. I mean, you know, there's Harriet Beecher Stowe who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, and that's got a lot of press and everything.
Phyllis
like that.
Wheatley?
Yes, yes, yes. But in terms of the broad, when I say great, I mean the variety and the productivity of Edith Wharton is really extraordinary. I mean, she's up there in the range of writers, short stories, novels, poetry, travel writing, interior design. You know, she was a great designer. I mean, she wrote about American houses. She was very interested in gardens. She was involved in the First World War, living in France, and she was really a French war hero. She was decorated by the French government, and she was actually buried in a cemetery that was, you know, that honored war.
Why
heroes.
Was she decorated by the French government?
Because during the First World War, instead of leaving Paris, she stayed in Paris. She set up shelters for women. She set up homes for Belgian refugees after the Germans had marched into Belgium. She took trips out to the actual war zone by car and wrote about the trips to, you know, and the war effort there. So she was very involved in that.
Perhaps you should mention that she was a woman of no little means.
Okay. You know, the expression keeping up with the Joneses is sometimes said to have applied to her family. Her maiden name was Jones. She came from a very well-to-do New York patrician family. She was friends with someone that you're particularly fond of, Theodore Roosevelt. They were both New Yorkers.
They were friends?
Yeah. They were New York City buddies, so to speak.
Okay, so the upper crust, Roosevelt
well, she
family,
was
the
very,
upper
very,
crust.
She was more upper crust even than Theodore Roosevelt. Okay. She goes back to the Dutch settlers of New York. Rensselaer, I think, is one of her family names.
Right.
So she is very, very patrician.
She largely wrote about upper class society, largely.
Absolutely, and that's why Ethan Frome is something of an anomaly in her corpus.
One reviewer, biographer of her, said this about her characters. He said, as a group, Mrs. Wharton's characters would be puzzled to know why the Lord's Prayer should include such a homely clause as, give us this day our daily bread.
That's very amusing. She was a snob, and she was an anti-Semite, and she had a lot of characteristics which would be very, which would sort of, you know,
be objectionable, of course.
Be objectionable today. And, you know, I go back far enough in the academy to know when the women's literature was coming into the fore, you know, when women were trying to bring out writers who were female and introduce them into the canon, and say where they're looking around. So academic scholars, female scholars, were looking for women that they could bring into the curriculum. And Edith Wharton, of course, would have stood out, you know, like like a sore thumb, to use a tired, you know, phrase. But she was problematic for these female scholars because she was too patrician, she was too upper class, and they wanted women who represented the marginalized, or shall we say, undervalued or underrecognized women. And so for a long time, they kept her at arm's length. But it's pretty hard.
It's my understanding. So she was born in 1862. By 1899, there was a volume of her short stories that were published. She won a Pulitzer Prize for Literature in 1921. That was a year after that. I don't know her most famous work, but I've certainly heard of The Age of Innocence. I haven't read it, but I've heard of The Age of Innocence and the House of Mirth. But I also read that, much like the public reacted against Fitzgerald after the Great Depression, there was a similar reaction against Edith Wharton. Is that accurate? At least immediately after her great success.
Actually, I can't really speak to that. I know that The Age of Innocence is an interesting story about the Pulitzer, but that the Pulitzer was awarded by the committee. There's a committee that was the Pulitzer, and the committee recommended Sinclair Lewis's Main Street for the award. But the head of the Pulitzer Board, I think it was Nicholas Murray Butler, who was the, I think, the president of Columbia University, he overruled the Pulitzer committee and gave the prize to Edith Wharton. Now, it might have been a recognition that, you know, she was long overdue. I mean, she'd been around a long time. Sinclair Lewis was a very young writer. And the interesting thing is Sinclair Lewis never objected. I mean, he actually was very good about it, and he felt that she deserved it, and he became friends with her after. That's a sort of small story.
So she was a woman, you know, tons of money, very successful author, and struggled deeply with depression, treated according to the means of the day, and poured herself into writing, married for years before eventually getting a divorce, never had any children. So behind the scenes, it sounds like a rather difficult life.
I would say, now I'm not a psychologist and I'm not a biographer of Edith Wharton, but I would say she's a perfect example, or she's a good example of someone who suffered from a terribly unforgiving parent. Her mother was really Mommy Dearest before they had Mommy Dearest. You know, the reference to Joan Crawford writing, the daughter of Joan Crawford. Her mother didn't want her to read novels until she got married. Her mother disapproved of her writing. Edith Wharton was an extraordinarily self-taught young woman. I mean, she read voraciously in her father's library, and she was interested in writing from a young girl. And this was not what young girls in her social world did. They were brought up to become married and to ornament their husbands' lives. And this is really what The Age of Innocence is all about. Basically, Edith Wharton looks back at an earlier period of New York life, New York society, and describes what that world was really like. And it was a terrifying world. And she married someone, not of her own volition, because her parents didn't like the man that she was first going with and that she was in love with. And so they attached it to somebody who was, you know, who was himself a real problem and had mental problems all his life.
Right.
And I don't think Edith Wharton's depression was unusual. I don't think she was, you know, I don't think she had mental illness. I think she had suffered. She was very unhappy for a long time, and her writing was a big release. Mm-hmm. And when she finally met someone that she did fall deeply in love with, and actually, I think, for the first time really experienced sex in a way that satisfied her, it turned out he turned out to be something of a bounder, to use an old word.
Right. It's interesting as you talk a little bit about her biography. It's so tempting to want to look into her works and find parallels between individuals she knew and quote unquote real life and individuals she wrote about. Later in her career, she wrote an essay about writing. And one of the things she said is, don't do that. Don't try to find the person behind the character. She said, the moment that person is in my book, the moment that person is in my story, he or she is no longer real. This person's now has his or her own identity. So it's just kind of interesting, because we've talked about Fitzgerald and other authors drawing from real life, and she didn't really want to tolerate critics trying to navigate who she was writing about.
She was really an artist. I mean, there's no other way of putting it. She was a literary artist, and she attached herself to Henry James when James was, you know, already quite senior, and became a great friend of James, and actually was responsible for the publication of James' great edition, the New York edition, which he didn't know about, because Scribner, who was her publisher and had been James's publisher, she went to Scribner and she told him, I want you to bring out an edition of James's works. Don't tell him about it. I will subsidize it. She made so much money from her own writing, apart from the money that she had, that she basically was the support for that New York edition. And she admired him as an artist and became a great friend of his.
What's interesting to me is she wrote Ethan Frome, at least it was published in 1911, when she was 49 years old. And when she described when she finally matured as an author, she said it was the writing of Ethan Frome that where she finally mastered her craft.
That's interesting.
What explanation do you have about that? Or why do you think she would say that?
I'm not sure, because the book that I identify with as Wharton's first great book is The House of Mirth, which I believe was something like 1905. So it would have been a few years before she wrote Ethan Frome. Maybe she felt that maybe because she was writing about a subject and an environment that was so different from what she was used to, and that she was so successful at it, that maybe her sense might have been that she was able to master something that was completely outside of her ordinary frame of reference, and that might explain something of it.
I have to admit, so Ethan Frome is not very long. I've got the Penguin Classic edition here, and you know, it's just barely 100 pages long. Mm-hmm. But I will say it's hard to put down.
It is a book. My memory fails me, but I believe I was assigned that book in school. Now, whether it was in junior high school or high school, I don't recall, but I'm almost sure that it was a book that would be regularly assigned, largely because it's so short that the teachers could expect the students to finish it without having to, before the age of Sparks Notes and Cliff's Notes.
Dad, before we move into the actual substance of Ethan Frome, a question more generally about American literature. And I know that like James, she bridges the pond, doesn't she? I mean, she spent so much time in Europe, really, I think much of her life in Europe. Mm-hmm. But when critics talk about Edith Wharton, they often compare her to the romantics that preceded her. Can you help us understand what's going on in the early 20th century where these writers, and she's a New England author, again, she's in Europe, but she's from New England. How does her approach to writing differ from Emerson and from Thoreau? Where does she take the field of literature in her lifetime?
That's a very good, it's a probing question, and it's one I'm not sure I can give a complete answer to. But I see Edith Wharton's work in many respects as, you know, being a, it doesn't appear to be what it in fact is. In other words, if you look at a book like The House of Mirth or The Age of Innocence, it's set in society and pretty much, you know, upper class society. But there are images in it of the world below that upper class, which is what we see basically in Ethan Frome. And I think Edith Wharton fits into the movement in American writing in the late 19th century and French writing in the late 19th century that is known as naturalism. That is a form of writing in which the world as it is, the realistic world, is presented, but that realistic world is bound up with a philosophy which tends to be rather, shall we say, pessimistic or fatalistic.
Anyone who's read Ethan Frome is smiling right now, understanding exactly what you mean. And I should pause. Dear listener, if you have gotten this far into the episode, I might encourage you, if you've not read Ethan Frome, to turn us off. Go get Ethan Frome, read it, and then come back, because the punch of the book really is in the ending. So
yeah, you don't want to spoil it.
We are about to ruin it for you. So please, if you are running through the park, don't run into a tree. Just go listen to Planet Money or something. And come back to Island Idols later.
That's a great recommendation, Aaron. I agree with you, because there's no way you can talk about the book without spoiling it for somebody who's never read it.
And in fact, many of the first readers and the critics, she commented that the critics did not like it. They thought it was too grim. And yeah, it wasn't until the 1940s when it became a stage play that there was it was rediscovered, and it became one of her most popular works. Do you want to give a brief summary of the story, Dad?
Well, it's a story of a young man. Of course, the story is set in a part of Massachusetts, a fictional town, but it's very
Darkville,
rural.
Massachusetts.
It's very rural. It's largely poor. I mean, the central character, Ethan Frome, is a poor farmer or a poor land. You know, he has got a small farm. He's cut timber. It was a man who, he's a young man at the start of this, at the story, you know, at the beginning, the story is framed. We see him as an older man.
Right.
And then we go back and hear the story about how he came to be what he is now.
Right. And it's a little bit like, It's a Wonderful Life in that, well, he wants to go off and become an engineer. He wants to go to school and become an engineer, but his parents both die. For some reason, he can't sell the land, and his only option is to come and work the land.
Well, what happens is his parents don't die. He comes back and he starts to help them. They're sick. The father's
okay.
He comes back, and then the father dies, and then he's got the mother, and the mother dies, and then he's left with this property. So his dreams, his early dreams, he just starts out, and you can tell he's got potential. But it's unrealized because he's not able to finish school. And so he's stuck in this farm. And then as his mother is dying, some cousin, some woman comes and takes care of her.
That's right. She was a cousin.
And he sort of doesn't know what he's doing. And he sort of feels gratitude towards her. And he basically proposes and they get married. So,
and Dad, I should stop and say any sensitive reader at this point is already drawn in very early on at this sense of regret. I mean, we all know what it's like for a dream to be unrealized. And so you're drawn in to Ethan's life quite quickly. And because she begins at the end with this old, I don't know how old he is, but this old man.
It's only in his 50s.
My goodness. Well, he seems older.
Right,
he seems
right.
Fragile. There's been some smash up. He's been in some accident, And immediately you know, okay, this story is about what happened to him.
Right.
And that's the flashback, if you will. Most of the book is a flashback.
Right. And in the story, we begin to see the situation. He's married this woman. The woman is absolutely a pill. I mean, she is, you know, she is a poster child for Puritan, you know, niggardliness and, you know, and self-righteousness and everything that is
her name
impossible.
Her name is Zina.
Her name is Zina.
Zenobia is her full name. She goes by Zina. And there's she's not a pleasant person, although we should note that she was there when his mother was dying.
Right.
That's not a mark against her. We should also note that Edith Wharton is very careful to say, well, she's 7 years older than Ethan when they got married. So she must have been 28. He was 21 years old, right?
Sort of close to, yeah. Yeah.
I think that's right. Because at the by the time right. the action is happening, she's 35 and he's 28. And but early on in the marriage, you know, Ethan stopped listening to her. Now, you could argue it's because she was such a pill, as you put it. But I just want to note that I think Edith Wharton is very subtly making it's more complex than she's simply the Wicked Witch. Ethan Frome is a young man. He doesn't know what to do with her. And he just he early on in the marriage, he tunes her out.
OK, I mean, I know you like to see the complexity in these marriages and these relationships, and that may be true.
I like to see the complexity that the authors are providing.
Okay. But I would say that another way of putting it is Edith Wharton shows you how two people can be thrown together, you know, in circumstances that they're not prepared for and they don't recognize the implications of it. And so very quickly, it's a mismatch. And very quickly, that mismatch turns into a marriage that they basically go along with. Mm-hmm. It's clear that Ethan is a sympathetic figure. But it's a sympathetic figure in terms of one of the things that Ethan Wharton writes about in this book and in other books is waste. It's a waste of a life. You know, a life is spent, wasted. All the potential, all the energy, all that intellect is not put to use. It's not expended wisely. It's just wasted. And this is what we see. And at some point in the book, Ethan thinks that to himself, too. Now, of course, we have to introduce the younger cousin or figure, Maddie Silver, who comes in to help Zina and, of course, is an attractive young woman. And naturally, there's an attraction between Ethan and Maddie. And so you have a kind of a triangle here. And that becomes an issue in many of Wharton's books.
Okay. We are so delicately not bringing out the end quite yet. It's interesting, Dad, how you and I, you know, approach it a little bit differently. In fact, let's go ahead and leave literature for a moment. And Dad, I'm not getting into politics, but I want to ask you, have you ever heard about the Billy Graham rule?
No.
All right. I do not want to walk down politics, but have you heard about the Mike Pence rule?
Oh, don't sit with a woman who's not your wife.
Basically. Now, originally, it was the Billy Graham rule. You know, Billy Graham was a dashing young man in the 50s. He was on the cover of every magazine. And
I remember.
And he knew that, you know, whatever ministry he wanted was going to be torn into shreds if there was an indiscretion. And so he wanted to protect himself. So he made a rule, at least for himself, I assume it was for every member of the Billy Graham organization or association.
I did not know that.
That basically, I don't know exactly what it was, but the basic spirit of the law was I'm not going to be alone with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for a lot of, I know because this got revisited because apparently Mike Pence he's an evangelical. And so he and a lot of people, you know, they try to live by that. Now it gets complicated if you're an employer and so forth and access to power. But the spirit of it is trying to be careful, recognizing that sometimes the heart wants what the heart wants, and one should try to be careful so as not to fall, not to stumble. And but it's the type of attitude that's absolutely lampooned by those who, I don't know, have a different ethic or a different worldview. But it's interesting.
Oh, who live in the world?
Well, no, we're all in the world. And I think, you know, oddly enough, those who have this view, like I would look at Ethan Frome and say, hey, buddy, why don't you treat Maddie like a younger sister? You know, instead of treating her like a romantic interest, what would it look like and how would your life have been different if you had enough self-control to say, you know what?
But why self-control? His wife is impossible. I mean, she's not really a wife.
She is. So this is, look, I don't want to, my critique is not that she should have written another story. I think it's a beautiful story. I think it's a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
I can't help but read it without saying, I know what Ethan should have done. You know, it's like, I am, you know, this is the wife you have. And instead of just tuning her out, care for her where she is. Now, she may bite you, she may hate you, but, you know, this is your lot. And, you know, take care of her as best you can.
That's why you're a pastor.
Interestingly, do you know L.M. Montgomery? Do you know, what about the Canadian author, L.M. Montgomery? She's famous for Anne of Green Gables.
Oh, Anne of Green Gables, yeah. I always think of E.L. Montgomery.
A contemporary, I think, of Edith Wharton, and clearly not as famous, but she, as I was reading this book, I thought of her character. She has a character named Marilla, who is just a pill. I mean, just awful. Now, she had the good sense of never to let Marilla get married, all right? But Marilla's brother, Matthew, lives with her. And as I was misremembering it, I thought they were married, but they weren't. Matthew was her brother. But you just saw him engage with her with a kind of tenderness that she didn't deserve. And there's something compelling about that. That's not this story. Ethan Frome never seeks to, go out of his way to be tender towards her. And I'm not saying it would have helped, but you're right. I mean, certainly as a Christian, I guess, and as a pastor, I just wanted to take Ethan aside and say, buddy, you know, this isn't the way you're to take care of your wife. And it's, you know, certainly not the way you're to live with your,
you know, one of the things I would say, which is not a response to what you're saying, really, in terms of the argument that you're proposing, but writers write about the world that they know. They don't write about the world as it ought to be.
Yeah.
Or even as they think it ought to be.
And it wouldn't be this. Absolutely. And in fact, that's what Edith Wharton said at one point. I mean, she made that exact point that a writer needs to write about the world that she knows. And Edith lived in a marriage that was clearly unsatisfying. And she wrote about it.
That's right.
And I found it to be a remarkable story and a good story, but it's a tragedy.
And you know what's interesting? This is a side point. The Age of Innocence, which is probably her best known book, was made into a film. And you know who directed that film? Martin Scorsese. Martin
really?
Scorsese is the last person you would think of directing a film of an upper class 19th century American society.
Well,
so I just think that's a side issue.
We haven't spoiled the story yet, but Zena is she's sickly or a hypochondriac, and she believes that she sees that there's something between Ethan and her cousin.
Yes.
And it seems clear that she wants to get rid of her cousin.
Exactly.
And so she says, we need to hire a nurse who's going to be able to take care of me, because Maddie is not quite capable of really taking care of a home. She's a little sickly herself or a little weak herself. And so Zena decides we're going to send her off. Hope she, you know, we can't take care of her. She's got to take care of herself. And we need to find a way to hire a nurse. And Ethan is so upset, but he's not upset enough to stand up to Zena and protect Maddie. But the one thing he's going to do is she wants their hired hand to take Maddie to the train station. He says, no, I'm going to do it. And so he takes Maddie off in the buggy to the train station. And what happens?
Okay, you want the end of the story? I mean, there's no alternative. I mean, Maddie has nowhere to go. What can she do? She really has no money. She has no job. She has no place to live.
And it's not clear based on her health that she's really going to be able to get a job that supports her.
Whatever. She is really has nowhere to go. And Ethan, who thinks maybe he can run away with her, doesn't even have the money to buy a ticket so they could run away to the West. The West is presented as some kind of, you know, free open space where they can start a new life. Mm-hmm. So there is nothing for them. There's nowhere for them to go. And to generalize before the actual plot decision, one of the things Edith Wharton shows in this book is people's limited circumstances. I mean, for someone that had so much money as she had, she was very conscious of the fact that people really often had no choices. They didn't have the choices that people with even modest means have. And so here's this young couple who were clearly in love with each other. They are each to the other is their one with their one bright spot, their one bit of happiness in a dreary, dreary world. And one of the great achievements of Ethan Frome is to create that environmental atmosphere, which is as stark and as unremitting as the conclusion to the book. And so Maddie, actually, he wants to take her on a sleigh ride down this hill. And at the bottom of the hill is a big elm. And it's very, you have to be very careful when you do the ride not to hit the tree. And Maddie basically suggests, you know, why don't we just go on the sleigh and go straight into the tree, and at least we won't have to worry about tomorrow. So basically, she's offering him a suicide pact. And of course, he doesn't want to acknowledge that, you know, he can't. But then when he comes to think about it, he himself sees that there's no way out, no way out. So he, instead of getting on the sleigh where he sits behind her and he can steer it, he gets on the sleigh in the front, figuring that he will go right into the tree. And of course they do. The only thing is, ironically, tragically, they don't get killed.
They both survive.
He survives, and she is paralyzed.
She's paralyzed. And the piste de resistance, who takes care of them for at least 20
and
years.
They wind up back. So the three of them wind up back in the house where they were. Only Zena is now the nurse.
Zena's the nurse.
And Maddie is the one who was, you know, sour.
The one who took care of his mother. The one who exactly. needed someone to take care of her now spends the best years of her life taking care of the woman he loved or loves and taking care of him. He's hobbling by trying to make a living in his 40s and his 50s. It's a stunning conclusion.
As one of the narrators that tells the story to the framing character says, you know, they'd be better off in the grave instead of in the grave that they're living in.
That's right. That's right. I don't know who Percy Boynton is, but he described Edith Wharton's writing in 1923. And he said this, he said, in all these stories and in all her other stories, though Mrs. Wharton has no ethical thesis to present, she leaves no doubt as to her ethical convictions. Taken by and large, man is surrounded by forces quite beyond his own powers to control or defy. If he is a little man in a little world, little forces can intimidate him. If he is a more primitive creature in a more natural world, forces as relentless as the elements can crush him. And then he goes on to describe he just says a little bit about Ethan Frome, and he says that Ethan and Maddie's end was a life sentence worse than capital punishment. So, I mean, what do you think about that, Dad? Man is surrounded by forces quite beyond his own powers to control or defy. Is it fair to say that's Edith Wharton's assessment of the world?
That's a description of naturalism with a capital N. This is Émile Zola, Guy de Maupassant. In America, it's Frank Norris, McTeague, Stephen Crane, you know, the Red Badge of Courage and the Open Sky, the Open Boat, and all those stories that show how Maggie Girl of the Streets, the great story by Stephen Crane, in which people are caught in a world. It's both the social world and it's a natural world that they cannot overcome, and that often, you know, conspires against them and destroys them.
And is that, would you say that Henry James is similar?
No. James is more complicated than that. Although James was a great admirer of those writers, his world is a little more, James puts more emphasis on the individual choice and individual responsibility that people make in their lives. Mm-hmm. He gives them more room to maneuver their lives than the naturalists do. Now, in Edith Wharton, you don't ordinarily, in a book like Ethan Frome, you can see it clearly. But when you look at a book like The House of Mirth or The Age of Innocence, you don't see it so clearly because the settings and the props are so elegant and so attractive. So you don't think of naturalism when you see people in wonderful houses with, you know, wearing new bonnets and great dresses and engaged in sumptuous meals. You don't think of them as a naturalistic world, but in a way it's just the same thing, because
they're controlled by the conventions of their society, whereas Ethan Frome is constrained by his poverty or by his I don't know how else to say it, his limited resources or the strength of an elm tree on a wintry night.
Yeah, exactly. But we don't tend to see social constraints as being so powerful as they are. And in The Age of Innocence, and the reason I think that book has become such a lodestar for Wharton and for readers, is because she makes it so clear that those social conventions can be as killing as the poverty in something like Ethan Wharton, like Ethan.
I have one more literature question, and then I want to say things that you are going to kindly make fun of me for. Is there any similarity between Edith Wharton and Flannery O'Connor? Is it only Ethan Frome that might make one think of one of Flannery O'Connor's macabre short stories?
That's a good question. I don't really see... I mean, Flannery O'Connor had a much more religious...
Catholic?
Religious and spiritual perspective on the goings-on in her stories. I don't think Edith Wharton has that perspective.
Okay.
I think it's,
but they both had style and some panache. And the end of Ethan Frome is, and again, I hope that you listened to it or read it before you listen to us talk about it. Dad, in one sense, I wouldn't want the book written any other way. I mean, I loved it. It was a tragedy. It was gripping. Her writing is sparse and engaging. I think these themes of regret and of loneliness and of love and of marriage, I think they're all very, very profound and thought-provoking. But it's so difficult as a Christian to read a story like this and not be upset that Ethan Frome isn't the man I want him to be, but to say, I don't think he was without choice. I mean, I understand what you're saying. I think I intellectually understand what naturalism is. But as I was reading Ethan Frome, I thought about the story of this seminary president, Robert McQuilkin, who, you know, decades ago, his wife had Alzheimer's. And, you know, he was in the prime of his career. He was a president of an institution, maybe a Bible college and seminary. But for some reason, so he had the means to care for her, have someone care for her throughout the week. But he tells this story. He said, you know, only when she was around him was she placid, was she calm and happy. And so he said that, you know, he had no other choice but to give up his career and to to attend to her when she could really give him nothing at that point. I'm not saying it's parallel. So the point is, that's the end of his career.
Mm-hmm.
Now, thankfully, he had the means to do it. Obviously, he was able to retire, and that's no small thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something, it's a different story, but it's a beautiful story. And it's not Edith Wharton's story. And I'm not faulting her for that. I'm just saying, I can't help but say there's another story to be written about a man with an awful wife who doesn't decide to transfer his affections to the vivacious young 20-something, but who instead decides that a life worth living is a life pouring into this woman who gives him very little in return, with the hope that one day her heart will soften. Again, it's not this story. I'm not criticizing Edith Wharton for not writing the story that my morals can, mm-hmm. Can dance about. I just wanted you to know that those are the type of things that cross my mind as I read something like this.
Yeah, but you want to project moral values or moral precepts onto art or fictional creations. And you can't do that. You know, even Henry James said, you have to give the artist his, her right to their donné, that is, to their subject.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have them, you can't have them write a story that you want. You have to read the story that they write.
I think that's fair. I mean, Edith Wharton gets to write what she wants to write, and I enjoyed the reading of it. But if a critic is going to come and say that her point is that man is surrounded by forces quite beyond his own powers to control or defy, I just can't agree. So I would say, good job. Yeah.
You don't have to agree with the worldview, and you don't have to agree with the perception of reality.
But is disagreeing projecting my morals on her? I guess I don't think I'm doing that.
You're accepting the story for what it is, but you're wishing that the people in the story, if they were taken out, would act differently.
I'm pausing. I'm thinking. I suppose. Yeah. I mean, to the extent that she wrote characters who were so compelling, which is amazing that she did it in such a short amount of time, that in so
few. You're talking about Edith Wharton. You should look at, I mean, The Age of Innocence is a classic example of that. You know, where the character, the main male character, is drawn to this woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's clearly he's in love with her. Clearly she's in love with him. He can't break away from his marriage, the woman that he's been, connected with. And in the end, he doesn't. So you could say, well, in that book, Archer, who's the man, just stays with his wife and has made the choice to live up to his marriage,
right,
and stay with his family. And he lets Ellen, the woman of his heart, whom he has sort of led on, go back to Europe and not. And when his children get older and they realize that he was in love with her, they look at him and they say, gee, Dad, why don't you just go for it?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he wasted his life. She really had no satisfaction in her life. But from your point of view, you could say, well, he held on to his vows.
Yeah, yeah. I think it really does. It does. Well, let me ask you, and I guess we need to wrap up, but it does get to the question of what is beautiful, doesn't it? I mean, what do you see as beautiful? And I don't think we're all going to agree when it comes to something as complex as literature. We're not all going to agree about the beauty of a particular story. Now, just because I don't like what Ethan did doesn't mean I don't find this book.
You don't admire the art.
I love it. But, mm-hmm. but I think it's a very complex question to address, and maybe we can talk about it, devote some time to it.
Beauty is a great word, and it's a very hard word to use. You know, what we're talking about is aesthetics.
Yes.
And the sometimes stories are ended, like the movies, the cliche of the happy ending. even though the story doesn't really lend a happy ending, you slap on a happy ending because you know the audience is really going to go for it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, mm-hmm. you put that on, even though the aesthetics of the movie would lend itself to a tragic ending.
Right.
So, you know, the artist is always, you know, sometimes, you know, the artist doesn't satisfy the reader or the viewer. And sometimes the artist satisfies the reader or the viewer, shall we say, unrealistically or informally. And then the writer, the serious critic says, well, you're copping out, you know, you're being an
actor. I can't remember the name of the movie, Dad. And I think I brought it up on an episode long ago because I watched it a few months ago. But it's Will Ferrell, Emma Thompson, and Dustin Hoffman. And the main character is a man who's living out he's living a life being simultaneously written by Emma Thompson. She's an author.
Oh, I saw that movie. And I see that you're a house.
I don't know, maybe. And at the end of the movie, so friends, I'm so sorry if you are wanting to watch this movie, but at the end of the movie, he realizes, I mean, all of her main characters die. And at the end of the movie, he realizes that he has to die. And she can't kill him. And Dustin Hoffman, who's the literature professor, reads her revised version where the character doesn't die. And he says, it's not bad. But when the character died, it was a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, I don't mind. Edith Wharton isn't asking my opinion. I can't get into her mind and know what she wanted to accomplish. I feel like I know a little bit of her history and a little bit of her background and a little bit of the movement that she was a part of. And so I perceive that I understand the goal was to show that man is surrounded by forces quite beyond his ability to control or defy. So I have no reason to argue against that. And I'm also not reading Ethan Frome and sort of cheering because the bad guy now has to be tortured for the last, you know, years of his life. I mean, it's not that at all. I walk away, like I said before, unconvinced that man is as impotent to find a good life in the midst of tragic circumstances as Ethan Frome might lead one to believe.
Well, that's very well put. But, you know, a side issue about Edith Wharton. She is apart from the description we've made about her naturalistic, you know, philosophy, if you will, she is also really a chronicler of a world that no longer exists. You know, this is the world that was in New York in Age of Innocence. This is the world Lily Bart grew up in, you know, where she had no money, but she lived in a world mm-hmm. where people had more money than she did, and she kept scrounging to keep in that world, but she couldn't do it, you see. Why I think one of her greatest novels, which is not as well known, is one thing called The Custom of the Country. And that very title, The Custom, meaning the mores of a country, she captures a world that is gone, but that we understand, that we know because she writes about mm-hmm. it. And this is the way in which novelists, in some ways, are truer to life than historians, you see. Historians write the stories about the past, but the novelists show us the past. Mm. And that's no small feat. Mm. And I think that Edith Wharton does that in much of her fiction. Ethan Frome is a bit of an outlier just in, you know, in the form and in the subject matter. But overall, she is a writer who, if you want to know something about America in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, she will show you that world. I mean, the world that she knew. And to give an idea of how impressive she was to other people, Scott Fitzgerald, when he was very young, he just made a splash, but he was in his early 20s. Was in France. And of course, Edith Wharton was living in France, and Fitzgerald wanted to visit Edith Wharton. And he screwed up his courage to, you know, communicate with her, and she invited him over. But of course, in typical Scott Fitzgerald fashion, he got drunk before he went over. And the incident is something in American literary history. But Why did Fitzgerald want to see Edith Wharton? Because he recognized her as a writer that had captured a world that he had was doing what he was trying to do. Fitzgerald was trying to capture his world, and he saw in Edith Wharton someone who was able to, who had done that in an earlier, for an earlier period. And that's a great homage, as far as I can say.
Well, Dad, thank you for this this introduction to Edith Wharton. That's useful and helpful and enjoyable, and I appreciate it. And it's always good to talk to you.
Well, it's great to talk to you, Aaron, and take care of yourself
yes,
and your family.
Likewise. Aloha, Dad.
Bye.